Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 203 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and we're fresh back from the Smithsonian's Become a Pilot Day at the National Air and Space Museum. Maybe we'll mention that a little bit, but first, let me introduce the co-hosts. First is our aviation historian and military aviation expert, David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog.
Hey, Max. I realized at 5 minutes before we started recording that I hadn't unpacked anything from last weekend. We had a great time, but it was exhausting.
Also co-hosting is our consultant. He's a commercial pilot and a controller refugee, Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Controller refugee. Now, that's an interesting one. I don't think I've ever heard that title quite before, but listen, it's nice to be here from Chicago, and it was such a good time at Air and Space last week, and I want to thank, of course, Jack Daly and Frank McNally and Vicky Portway and all those people and Isabel, Everybody that made our stay just astounding. And the one thing I'm glad about is that I got out before they made us sweep the floors. I really am happy about that.
But they did make us fold up the tablecloths and disassemble the tables, so we helped a little bit.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
And you know me, I'd sweep the floors there.
You'd probably collect the dust.
Yeah, just...
Oh, man. Our guest this episode is Carl Valeri. He's a flight instructor, he's an airline captain, and now he's host of the new Aviation Careers podcast. Carl, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me. I'm here in what was sunny Florida, from the eastern side of Tropical Storm Debbie, about to be in the eye wall.
Yeah, good luck with that. Well, hopefully the power stays here. On. And
wasn't there a movie like that once? Debbie does Florida?
No.
Oh.
Well, Carl, you're creating an awful lot of online content these days. I mean, you already have the Stuck Mike Avcast and the expertaviator.com site. Why now the Aviation Careers Podcast?
Well, actually, the Aviation Careers Podcast, I couldn't fit it into anything else I was doing. It didn't have a home. In other words, I had a specific audience, and you know, Expert Aviator really was my trying to give something back to the aviation community by putting out something once a week, like some type of a lesson. I talked about careers, but I've had so many years as a volunteer helping people when they're on furlough during a layoff, basically, with the airlines. And I see the same thing happening over and over and over again. I've been through three cycles now in the aviation industry, been through a bunch of furloughs, and I represent furloughed pilots. And you know, I was a little, it's out of frustration, actually. It was out of, you know, something I felt compelled to do. And everything else that I do, the podcasts, like with Sun and Fun Radio, with Stuck Mike Avcast as a guest on other podcasts, they aren't things that I do myself as far as production. The only thing I produce is Expert Aviator. But then I decide, you know what, let me give it a shot. Let me try it myself, because I couldn't get anybody else interested. And I really love interviewing people that are in this aviation career world. And I said, you know what, let me go ahead, give it a shot. And I'm very committed to it. I've already put quite a bit of money and time into it. And I think it's going to be something that I'll be able to do for quite some time.
Very cool. Yeah, and the results are good so far.
Yes, thanks. So my second episode, but I'm going on episode three, and the next episode is going to be about flight instructing part-time and how to become a successful flight instructor part-time. And I've had, I've been a flight instructor for so many years, and I've been able to make actually some decent money flight instructing. So I wanted to share that with people too. How can you actually make money as a flight instructor and even make money as a pilot? Well, I'm still trying to figure that one out, but but I love it. You know, this is a career that you have to go into because you're passionate about it, because you really enjoy it. Because, you know, my last career, I made a lot more money. As a matter of fact, in my one business, I actually made more money in one day than I made in a whole year my first time with the regional airline, first year.
Wow.
With the regional airlines.
Yeah.
Imagine.
Amazing.
That's how low the pay is. So you really have to do this because you enjoy it. It's great. It's challenging. It's very fulfilling. But it also is something that I think people just don't hear about and don't know about. So hopefully if I can get out there and tell more people about what it's like to be a pilot. But I wanted to do that not just through my own voice. I wanted it through other people's voices. And that's where I decided that I'm going to give a little bit of advice at the beginning of the show. But I really want to interview people that are currently in this job, in this career, or people that are involved in recruiting in this career of aviation. 90% is going to be flying jobs. Another 10% will be things like flight attendants and air traffic controllers like Rob. And, you know, people like Rob to say, hey, listen, this is a great job. I loved it. Or I didn't. And that's why I got out of it. That type of thing. And give people the why. Say, hey, this might work for me. But you have to go out there whenever you're trying something, you're doing anything in life. You have to define your goal and then go towards your goal and just keep in mind what that goal is and keep going towards it. Because you know what? It really is a varied path and it's truly a serendipitous journey on your way to whatever it is you do. I mean, you may decide after 10 years of flying, I don't want to do this anymore. And that's another thing I've been doing lately is counseling people how to change jobs. Maybe they want to be an attorney. Maybe they want to be sell real estate. So it's something you can do full-time. It's something you can do part-time. But as we say in the airline business, you know, it's the best part-time job in the world. Because once you get to that point, you get a lot of days off, actually.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Well, that's good. We're going to talk about that a lot more coming up. First, we're going to start out with some aviation news from the past week. And then we'll spend some more time talking with Carl about what he has going on. After that, David's going to teach us a little aviation history with his This Week in Aviation segment. David, you do have a segment for us tonight, right?
Oh, was I supposed to do that?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yes, actually, we will be doing the Martin M130, which was a flying boat, otherwise known as the China Clipper.
Oh, very cool. All right. After that, we'll have Steve and Grant from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast with their Australia Desk report. And Peter Johnson is back with his Across the Pond segment, so we'll look forward to that. We've got a few Grill the Geeks questions from our listeners, and we have a bit of listener mail, so we'll wrap up with that. First, though, let's get started with some aviation news. Are you guys ready?
Yeah.
We're ready.
Ready.
Our first story comes from the Washington Post. This is, after Osprey crashes, battle looms over deployment of U.S. transport aircraft to Japan. Well, the V-22 Osprey, which actually I think it was, well, not last week because we were at the museum, but I think the week before, David, if I remember correctly, we were talking about the Osprey. And on a training mission in Florida, there was a crash. The five airmen aboard were hospitalized, but otherwise okay, I guess. The Osprey ended up upside down. And now it seems that there's an uproar in Japan where the Osprey is set to be deployed later this year. There's a quote in the Washington Post. Japan's top government spokesman said last week the plan to deploy the aircraft to Japan this year couldn't move forward until Tokyo received assurances of its safety. Oh, boy. Do you think this is going to blow over, or do you think this is going to be kind of a serious issue?
Well, there's underlying issues to this story. The V-22 is replacing the CH-46 in the Marine Corps. I mean, that's a fact. The largest base in Japan is the island of Okinawa. And Okinawa has serious concerns about the amount of aircraft in that airspace because at this point, the island's population have grown around, so it's a very tight confines. If you look at the picture of on the Washington Post article, you'll see that there's a CH-46 coming down on final approach on the runway, and behind it are towns. It's a incident of where the environment has grown around the airport and the native population are concerned about a V-22 going down. And if it goes down anywhere near the Marine Corps Air Station there, it will go into a heavily populated civilian population. So they want guarantees it's going to be a safe aircraft. And the last two incidents earlier this year in Morocco, where we lost the whole crew, and the Air Force one that went down where the crew was injured, is adding to the tensions, because Japan has increased, always said that they didn't want the V-22 there because they're afraid of their population. So it's a matter of the growth around the airport. It's not just the aircraft. I mean, we have 200,000 Marines in the island, and we're trying to get some of them off, but it's a matter of where do you put airports are fixed points in time. The Okinawa airport, military air stations there were from World War II. We captured them, but there wasn't as much population around Okinawa. As time has grown on, the island has filled in with people, and the airports haven't gone anywhere and haven't grown any. So what you get is a collapse onto the infrastructure of the airport. So if a V-22 goes down, it will take out population. And I guess the concern is somehow we have to convince the Japanese that this is a safe aircraft. As I said 2 weeks ago, it's an aircraft that if it goes down, because it's a transport, it will take out multiple people. It's not a jet fighter that has a cockpit of two. That being said, it's the way the Marine Corps are going. The other choice will be to completely remove them from Okinawa and remove the base from Okinawa, which I don't think the Japanese would be very upset with.
This plane is perceived by them as being more dangerous than the planes they already experienced in that airport.
Yes, exactly. Their concern is the high fatality rate and the high incident rate of the V-22, which in the long run isn't any more high than anything else. But there's a perception that this technology is faulty and therefore very dangerous to the population of Okinawa.
Now, I also saw in CNN that the Air Force Squadron Commander was removed after this last incident. Is that an unusual action after something like this?
Yes and no. It depends upon the circumstances. You caught me off guard. I didn't see that article.
Sorry.
If there's negligence involved, it usually the base commander or someone has to take responsibility. In this case, I'm not sure why the base commander was relieved of duty, but there must have been some sort of human negligence involved with the CV-22 crash in outside of Tyndall.
Yeah, and there was no details provided in that CNN item mentioning that the commander had been removed, so I can't help with any of the details. The next item is from Business Week. Deadly private plane crashes prompt U.S. call for basics. Now, Business Week reports on data from the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, that shows that the crash rate on private pilot flights is up 20% since the year 2000, while there's been a 85% drop in accidents on commercial airliners. And they cite a number of reasons: inattention to basics, overloaded planes, failure to check weather reports, and just general flying mistakes. But I thought this was kind of interesting. Is general aviation diverging from commercial aviation in terms of safety?
I think it absolutely is, and it has been for quite a long time. I mean, let's be serious. We haven't had a 121, Part 121 crash with fatalities in the U.S. in some time. But GA, yeah, it's not doing so well. And, of course, when airplanes started going glass, the initial thought years ago, a decade ago, was that, wow, this is a boon for safety. Hmm. And all we have really seen is that people have managed to kill themselves in much the same way at faster speeds than they did in some of the older airplanes. Of course, the new airplanes, I mean, I won't pick out any particular one, but I mean, they have some very sophisticated automation on them, and people kind of let the computers run it, and sometimes they're not keeping track of where they are.
I'd have to agree with that, Rob. I think that we really are diverging from the airline world, and I think part of that is because we don't get involved in as much recurrent training. I know, you know, with the FAA safety program and as a volunteer, and we just had our safety stand down where we decide, okay, what are we going to look at this year? And one of the things that Max didn't mention was another big factor is loss of control. And I think that goes into what you were saying, Rob, where, gosh, you know, people just don't remember how to actually control the aircraft using needle ball airspeed, using stick and rudder skills, basic flying skills. And we've kind of lost that. And I think it's because we don't go back and train and practice that. I tell you, it was interesting. I had a commercial student not long ago, and the person had to turn the autopilot on all the time. I was like, what do you need that for? You just fly the airplane. And yeah, they just didn't feel comfortable flying. And then what happens? Those people go on to the airlines and fly. But I think getting to general aviation and speaking towards that, we have to look at loss of control in flight is becoming very large. And I think that part of that is due to the fact that we have more sophisticated airplanes, kind of like what Rob was alluding to, where maybe we have parachutes and we have computers and we have these screens that are going to get us out of trouble by pushing a button, and the button's going to auto-level the aircraft for you. And unfortunately, you know, we found recently we just lost a family friend actually in a crash in Ohio, and he, it looks like he didn't use all the safety procedures he could have. We had a recent crash here as a PC-12 that went through weather. People are starting to use their smaller aircraft and becoming, I think, a little more possibly complacent, but also more brazen. They're willing to go out and try things and think that the technology is going to save me, but the only person that's going to save you is you, yourself, your training. I think that's
important.
Thank
you for saying that, Carl. And I think one point that we should make, too, is that the loss of control issue that Carl mentioned is becoming the real problem in the industry, and not just at the bottom end. Now, the story that ran in USA Today was as a result of the NTSB GA forum in Washington last week. But if you look to some of the other 121 accidents that have occurred, Buffalo, with Colgan, Air France 447, there was the Air France flight in the 340 where they lost control. Luckily, they managed to get it back. But there are many, many loss of control accidents that are happening in large aircraft where people expect that the crews have a better idea of what's going on, and it's really a plague everywhere.
Oh, I think so, Rob. As a matter of fact, just an example, in a recent encounter with wind shear, I was flying, and during that encounter, normally we leave all of our flaps down and get out of the wind shear first, then we reconfigure the aircraft, and the person I was flying with actually took the flaps up. I was like, oh boy, you're killing all my lift here. You know, don't do this to me. And you know, you're heading down, and all I could think of is, oh, this is not going to be good. And, you know, you're sitting there saying, well, why is that? Why does that happen? And possibly it's we don't train that enough. And we need to look at those things. But you're right. And another thing about what you said about loss of control, when we do these safety programs and all the managers that I report to at the FAA, one of the things that they're telling us that we really need to put in all of our presentations is loss of control. And why are we losing control? Improper pre-flight planning and also not flying the airplane properly.
Let's move on to our third story. This is also from Business Week. NetJets to spend up to $9.6 billion on new planes. So NetJets is a fractional ownership company. Is that how you guys would describe NetJets? Is that a good way to describe them?
Sure. Like timeshare for a condo, sort of, except you don't have to move the condo.
but
timeshare. I mean, and that's true. I mean, and listen, this is certainly good news for Bombardier. Cessna didn't fare quite as well, at least initially, but they're going to keep the lines going. I think the people at Hawker Beechcraft, Hawker is, of course, in bankruptcy. I think they would have liked a little of this, but
would have been good.
Kind of didn't work out that way. But you have to admit, if anybody could pick a time to buy airplanes and get the best deal possible, it was probably now, and Warren Buffett's the guy to do it.
Yeah, no doubt.
Well, it's like walking in with a bunch of cash saying, I'll buy your airplane.
That's right. And it's a lot of airplanes. The article says firm orders is for 125 airplanes, 100 from Bombardier and 25 from Cessna. But it says that it could include up to 425 planes, which is just a phenomenal number. Do you think that the demand is out there for this? Where does demand for fractional aircraft come from?
Well, usually it comes from companies that either want to get into business aviation and don't want all the hassle of managing a flight department. So they kind of buy a piece of the action. It costs them a little more, but they don't have all the maintenance issues to worry about and scheduling and pilots and all that sort of thing. Sometimes it's also companies that are looking for extra lift. Maybe they have a flight department and they like to have a piece of another airplane around in case people get stuck somewhere and their airplane is busy. And it also prevents them from having to go out and, you know, add a third or fourth airplane to the fleet when maybe they don't really need it that often.
Where are all these pilots going to come from? Are they out there already, or is this sort of an incremental opportunity for
this is
pilots?
Where we go to Carl. Carl! Down to our correspondent, Carl.
You know, and that's the question I've been asking myself, where are these pilots going to come from? But, you know, even with a NetJets, for instance, where they actually had furloughed pilots and they have people out there on the street, well, they're probably going to be recalling those and having some other folks come in. The other thing that I'm interested in this order is that I had thought that part of this order was replacing airplanes, not just adding to. Is that true? Did you see that in the article? Because that's what
I think that was a piece of it.
Piece of it.
I don't
okay,
think
but
they're
not,
all brand new airplanes.
Yeah, yeah.
And they really run these NetJets airplanes. They really do.
Yeah, and I think NetJets won't have a problem finding pilots, just like the majors I don't think will have a problem finding pilots, because NetJets pays fairly well their pilots, and they have a really great lifestyle. So you're going to see, really, I think the problem is going to be within the regionals, because there aren't that many pilots coming through. The company I work for, we're having problems, you know, flying airplanes and getting the flights out lately, just because, you know, things are ramping up. There's going to be an issue here in the next 5 years, especially with all of, say, the majors. They're going to be retiring a lot of people, and where are they going to go? They're going to go to the regionals to find people and companies like NetJets. So I think you are going to see a sucking sound there at NetJets. But with that said, NetJets, with their good compensation, with their great benefits and their great lifestyle, I don't think they're going to have a problem finding people. But as far as in the pipeline here, every person that I talked to, and I go to a lot of different flight schools and have done some consulting, and said, gosh, you know, where are we getting these pilots? What we're seeing and what I've been seeing is that a lot of folks are coming from other countries, because this still is a great job. It's a great career in those other countries. Unlike in the United States, boy, you'd have a tough time going to fly for the airline of that country. For instance, people from Iran that come here, people from Saudi Arabia, although Saudi Arabia has gone the other way now, people from China will come here and train. And unfortunately, some of those folks are going back to their countries. So that's going to be an issue. And that's why another reason I'm starting this Aviation Careers podcast is that we need to start telling people, hey, the shortage is coming. It's just another wave. But it is coming, and NetJets, especially with these new orders and their growth, I think you're going to see that. And to add to that, you know, actually doing some work with some of these folks that fly these type of corporate jets and actually flying those folks around, the people that have the type of money that it takes to buy these jets, they normally aren't as affected by the economy as other folks are. It's normally the smaller jets where you find people are affected. So what happens, the smaller jets, the $1-3 million jets, they may be getting rid of those and deciding, hey, I'm going to go to NetJets. And that's why I think NetJets is going to grow, is because you're going to see some of those people getting rid of those. Plus, it's a direct write-off. And it looks good, too. You know, you got rid of the corporate aircraft, and now you actually are flying using another aircraft. You're renting it when you need it, that type of thing.
Again, we're with Carl Valeri from the Aviation Careers Podcast. Carl, as far as I can tell, you really like to help people learn to fly and advance their aviation careers. I mean, the passion comes out in your voice. Why is that? Why do you like doing that so much?
Well, I think the real reason is that ever since I was young, I've always believed you can do anything you want to do. You know, my dad and his family came to this country from Europe during World War II, and they realize that you can do anything you want here. And if you find something you're passionate about and you really enjoy, you need to actually go for it and actually try to achieve that goal, whatever it is in that career, whether it's being a broadcaster or being a dentist or a pilot. Well, I chose to be a pilot, and I really like being a pilot. And I said to myself, you know, I want other people to know about this, and I really want to share that. But like I said, I want to share it through my voice, but other voices out there. And I love teaching. So I said to myself, well, how can I do this? I can take the way I teach, because I teach all the time and do presentations, and then I can add that into careers and also try to motivate people to look at this as a career. I said, well, let me just come up with a podcast, because I was looking for a podcast to send people to. And I said, oh, you know what? It's not out there. And I think
so make your own.
So that's it. I did it very, very reluctantly. And some of the producers at some of the TV stations I do some consulting work with said to me, boy, that'd be great. I mean, there's nothing else out there. We did some research, and I think it'd be a wonderful thing to do. It goes along with my belief in giving back in a certain way to any type of community that you're in, whether it's your profession or whether it's a recreational community. It's something that you do, like tennis, et cetera. If you get to that a certain level in your career and you want to share that with other people, you need to go out there and do that. And, you know, as you know, some of you have read in, you know, ALPA magazine, my articles about volunteerism, you'll see that it's very important to me to give back to the community. And this is one of the ways I'm doing that, is by putting out this podcast. And what I'm finding in doing this is that the people that I interview and the people I talk to are so incredibly enthusiastic about this, about their careers in aviation, and they want to share so much. They ask me, can I come on again? Can I talk more about, I'm about to upgrade on the 777. Can I come on and talk to you, to the folks, about what it's like to upgrade on the 777, or what it's like to actually be a flight instructor in a simulator? And as a matter of fact, that was my last episode where I had somebody on who talked about being an instructor in the simulator. And that's one of the things that really got me going. And I think, too, something that pushed me over the edge to finally do this podcast was, I was at Sun and Fun and volunteering for Sun and Fun Radio, and they asked me to interview the WASPs, the Women Air Service Pilots.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
And they, when I started interviewing them, I didn't know a lot about them. And as I'm interviewing, I heard this, all the people that I talked to have this incredible passion about their career, about their job, about flying. And I said, gosh, this is amazing. How can I actually relate this to people? I could do this through interviewing, just like I'm doing now. And those people, what they went through, they actually, these women had to actually go out and pay for their licenses to go fly for the military. The military normally pays for those things. They had so many hardships that I realized, you know what? I can't complain, and what am I doing just sitting here thinking about this, about putting this podcast together? I'm going to have to go ahead and do it. So I said to myself, I really have to commit myself to it, and I'm going forward with it. So the biggest thing is trying to find people to interview, and finding people to talk about their passion. But as you get out there, you find out, yeah, there's quite a few folks out there, and you know, it's interesting. I'm learning so much by doing this, and I'm hoping the people that listen to it, and that's actually been the biggest benefit. They said to me, gosh, you know, I never knew that. I never knew that you could go out and become a simulator instructor full time, and the pay was pretty good. You know, it didn't pay very, you know, those type of things, or their lifestyle isn't in quite what they wanted to be. And so that was my push to go forward with this. And I ran it across the other folks at, you know, I'm with the Stuck My Gavcast. And, you know, it really was going to be just a series about aviation careers. But then I looked at all the different people that I have, I put down a list, and I have about 56 different interviews that I could do. And I said, wow, this is going to go a span of a couple of years if this is, I already have 56 on the list.
Sure. Now, the topics, the kinds of aviation careers that you're going to cover, it's not just limited to being a pilot, correct?
No, it's going to be, I'd say it's 90% pilot. It's also mechanics. A lot of people don't realize there's a lot that goes into flying. For instance, you look at some of the airlines, say they have 6,000 pilots or so, you'll see maybe 60,000 total employees. And I've worked some of those jobs. I was a reservation agent with an airline while I was on furlough. And, you know, that's a career path you can look at. Give you the benefits of being able to fly with the airline. And in some airlines, you can work from home. Those are things I never knew before. So I said, well, maybe this is something that can keep them in aviation. And say they want to fly, but they can't because of some physical challenge that they have that won't allow them to go forward into the career of aviation full-time, but they can do other things. You know, I actually had the privilege of teaching deaf pilots how to fly, and those people cannot go work for the airlines because they can't hear.
Yeah, sure.
Do other things with the airlines, and there's so many things that in computers, there's so many different career paths that can go, but the common theme is that we're all passionate about aviation. I think when I first met David, I said to myself, well, here's somebody, and all you guys, really, here's people that aren't currently doing much flying, except, you know, I think Robert's doing some instruction now, but they're passionate about it. We all come together, and we're passionate about this aviation. Even if I'm not flying the plane, we're all here and love being around airplanes, and right. That's why I love to get out and talk to the people on the ground, even at work. I'll talk to the ground crews and ask them, hey, you know, why do you like your jobs? Oh, I can work 3 days a week, and I still get to hang out and look at the airplanes. You'd be amazed at how many of those people know so much about the airlines and about the airplanes that are out there on the ramp.
Yeah, and this is a great point. I mean, there's a whole ecosystem of careers out there, you know, that support the aviation industry. I mean, that's a broad term, the aviation industry, and it's right. It's not just pilots and crew, but ground support and, you know, airport folks and route planners and dispatchers. And, I mean, there's just if you add it up, all the careers, made a list. I don't know how long it would be, but it would probably be a giant list.
Like I said, I have 56 already of different people that I want to interview. And it's just phenomenal. You know, a good example, my girlfriend, she was in the Navy, and she was in maintenance control. If you don't know, maintenance control are those folks that schedule maintenance and facilities and products, but parts to be in different places. And I was like, wow, there's something that I never knew. And actually, you know, she knew all about certain airplanes. I knew nothing about C-130s. Like, she knows a lot more about that than I do. And, of course, you know, being based in Antarctica, you know, that's how they used to get down there. And I was like, wow, you know, here's another avenue. I didn't realize there's people that are down there repairing planes in the middle of winter, and air traffic controllers especially. That's a great job, air traffic control. I tell you what's interesting is that you see a lot of pilots say, you know what, that's it, I'm done. I'm going to go out and become an air traffic controller because I'm going to make a whole bunch more money doing that. So there's another avenue they can go. And I, you know, as an aside, I had a student, one of my scary events in aviation, I lost an engine on takeoff, and he actually decided to go out and become an air traffic controller after that. I think that was terrific.
But and aviation, of course, there are those air traffic controllers that say, boy, what a dumb job. I want to go flying. Imagine that.
Yeah, but they can afford to fly. They can buy their own airplane.
Yeah, well, that's true. But, you know, I wonder if I can add something, or actually, I want to go off on a little bit of a tangent, Carl, on something you said, because I had a chance just this last week to have lunch with a neighbor of mine who has a son that's going to be a junior in high school this year. And Max, if you're not you, Max, this other fellow's name is Max. Max, if you're listening, go for it, baby. And, you know, he was really excited about trying to figure out how to become a professional pilot. And during the course of the lunch, one thing he said was that, you know, I've heard a lot of people, too, though, that say, you know, I wouldn't do this again. And, you know, so he said, what do you think? And I go back to one thing I've always told people, which is that when you go to college, get a degree in something that is something you're also interested in besides professional piloting. I know the people are probably going to kill me for this, but I'm just saying that I think it's always good to know how to do something else and find some other part of your life that you're passionate about. But the most important thing is that I think that people need to realize that that passion that Carl mentioned is the key. Yeah, you're right. You don't get the money, may not be what it used to be. And you can talk to people at United and Delta and I don't know how many others that lost their pensions. And that happens. It was a raw deal. But you know what? If you really like doing what you're doing, I don't care if you're a pilot or, as Carl said, a dentist or a truck driver or whatever. If you really get up in the morning and you really like doing what you're doing, that's going to make your life much different. Following the money, it just never tends to work.
Well, I wish I could say that better than you did. That was terrific. And you know what you said about getting a degree that's other than aviation, I think is key. And doing something you're passionate about is also key, because the people that I find that go into aviation that did it for the money and said, oh, I'm going to make the six-figure income and I'm going to have 20 days off a month. And then 10 years later, they're, you know, flying for a regional in the right seat, making $35,000 a year. They're the ones that are most disappointed. But also in flying, there's so many ups and downs. It is good to have another degree. You just need to have a degree to make yourself competitive if you want to go to the majors. You know, I'm a great example. You know, I studied computer science, math, and psychology. I was into artificial intelligence and programming computers. That's so outside of what I'm doing right now. But I enjoyed that, and that was fun. But I can always fall back on that if I had to. And I have. I actually had to at one point go back to sitting in a cube all day in an office building. You know, where you walk in the door and you sit inside at a desk. I know there's a lot of people I work with that don't understand that. They actually go inside.
Hey, watch what you say there, Carl. There's some of us slobs that actually have to do that every day.
I was waiting for a response from David. But that's, you know, that, Dave, I tell you, I give you guys a lot of credit for doing that. I mean, people that... There, I did that where I was actually, when I was programming and doing computer systems for banks, they would put me in the basement. I actually sat in the basement for a week, never saw the sunshine. And I said, you know what? I'm out of here. I can't do this anymore. And I'm too much of an extrovert to be able to sit here and do this all day. And so I didn't, a desk job, yeah, I could do it, but I really prefer to be outside and going.
Isn't that a great motivator sometimes, having an office job?
Yeah, it can, but you know, but then again, people like that consistency. Look at who I just interviewed, who said, gee, you know, I want to go to the same place every day. I'm sick of going and spending my nights in a hotel room in the middle of Mexico, and I wake up and I think I'm in Las Vegas, and then I'm San Jose de los Cabos. And I was like, oh, I understand that. You know, you wake up, you're like, what, where am I? What city am I in? You know, what is that? Oh, it says Los Angeles. Okay, good. That's why they don't want that anymore. So you're right. You know, there's benefits to being in an office every day. If you can go home, people can go home every night, and you can wash your clothes every night. I can't do that. You know, I get to do that once a week. And so there are those benefits. And you can go
to
the basement.
You're supposed to wash them?
Yeah, well... Rob, you know, I'd get it. You're the one of those guys that does it in the sink, don't you, on the open.
No, and that really is true. But I'll tell you the truth, and I think that someone that has a number of different interests, like you, Carl, and I certainly have too. I have never been disappointed that I have focused in just this industry. I mean, I never said, "Oh my gosh, I wish I could have been a doctor," or "I wish I could have been an accountant or an attorney or anything else." So many, I mean, every opportunity I've had, some worked out well, some really didn't work out as well as I hoped, but they've all been in the same industry. And honestly, I've still loved every minute of it.
That's great. That's great. And you know, that's wonderful. And that, you know, what's great about you and about people that are so diverse, and you find that with a lot of airline pilots, is that if, for instance, if I lost my job, say I had a heart attack or something happened to me where I couldn't go back to work, well, gosh, you know, this job doesn't define me. The industry does somewhat. I can still be passionate and be involved in something else in the industry.
Yeah, good point.
So don't necessarily have to fly. And that's what's great about, and that's what I admire about you, Rob, is that you do something else. And then, wait, you're also involved in this, in aviation still, and you're very passionate about it.
My wife just wants to make sure I don't get too passionate in the wrong way, but
yeah.
Not to exclude
her. Anybody that listened to last week's show will hear about that, but we'll go on from
right there. Now, Carl, the website is aviationcareerspodcast.com, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct.
And you have a Twitter handle for that as well?
Yeah, actually, it's Flying Careers is now the Twitter handle. I just got that today. And also Aviation Careers Podcast on Facebook. I wasn't able to get the handle I wanted on Twitter, but Flying Careers, you can get all those links right from Aviation Careers Podcast. There's a contact on there, and you can easily get in touch with me. And, you know, I love questions about the career of aviation. And what's interesting is that I'm just one person. Yeah, I have a lot of experience. I've dealt with a lot of different people and helped people and broker jobs in other countries and stuff like that. But the great thing is I have resources. If I don't know, there's so many people I can ask. And that's what's great about listening to podcasts like yours, is that you actually do learn something. That's I tell people actually to listen.
I know I do.
Oh God,
I
know, wait,
it's amazing, isn't it?
Don't let that secret out.
but it's true. You guys, actually, somehow serendipitously, I learned something. I just sit here and say, oh wow, I didn't know that. And there's that. I need to tell people to listen to this podcast because, especially, you know, I like a lot of the comments. Rob every so often has some gems and some duds, but
and I'm not even trying. I mean,
but there's certain things. It's like I want to take that and quote him on those things, and that's where
you know what's really neat. And talk about serendipitous. Flying Careers, your Twitter handle. I used to work for the Flying Careers magazine that was the original publication from the future. What was it called? FAPA, the Future Aviation Professionals. That was 25 years ago. But I think this is funny. It's coming back.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I think they have that website, FAPA.org again.
Yeah, that's Lewis Smith's organization. Right. He used to be FlightOps.com, and they finally went back to the old, because he was one of the original founders of FAPA. Yep. Yes. And so he just decided to go back to his roots, but he didn't get Flying Careers on Twitter. I'm glad you did.
Well, Lewis and I'll have to talk about that. Actually, Lewis is a great guy. I've had to actually work with him in the past because what we did is we were able to get our furloughed pilots free access to FlightOps.com, and that was a great website. He does a great job of helping people find other jobs in aviation.
They have a big career fair coming up here in Chicago this next weekend.
That's
for regional pilots. Yeah. This will come out on Tuesday, so it'll be this Saturday, part of the day, actually late in the day on Friday. I think they're doing something in the afternoon, and then also on Saturday, it's out by O'Hare somewhere. I can't be here because I'm going to be in Vancouver.
For those people that are thinking of going, I can't mention what airline he's with, but my first episode, the person that I interviewed will actually be there talking to folks. He'll be taking resumes for a certain airline.
Will they be giving people an extra nod if they say they know you?
That it may be in the negative. I'm not sure you want to mention my name. but you'll see a picture there, and if you see him, you know, say hi to him. But he has some great advice as to working for airlines overseas.
So there's no truth to the rumor that there's going to be a cardboard cutout of you in the doorway.
No, and you don't want one either. Believe me. Unless it's a big advertisement. Yeah, I'm kind of a little bit more robust than most. So I should get myself one of those Airplane Geeks T-shirts. I'd be a real good walking billboard for y'all.
But Carl, just briefly, what's going on at the Stuck Mike Avcast these days?
Stuck Mike, actually, you know, I tell you, that is something that I didn't realize would have so much momentum as it has. We've been doing the same thing, talking about learning to fly, living to fly, and loving to fly. And we do a lot of hangar flying for folks that are into actual aviation. It's a somewhat technical. And what has happened is it's grown because I think we have this incredible mix. And I think Victoria Neuville, who's one of our co-hosts, has done just a great job of putting together certain events. We had Sarah Fraher from Flying Wild Alaska. She came down to the Women Fly It Forward event that Victoria put on in Frederick, Maryland, right next to AOPA's headquarters. Mm. And we've actually grown into moving into more air shows, kind of like yourselves. We do more general aviation and flying and our passion for actual flying. And it's gotten it to the point where we have an audience that's building, And it's not as broad as your audience, but it's very specific to actual just actually flying the airplanes. But Len Costa, he's terrific. He's also an airline pilot. And as a matter of fact, he's just now an upgrade for captain. And Rick Felty, who does incredible video work. And then Victoria, who's actually in sales in aviation insurance, and she's becoming a flight instructor. And then there's myself. We have this great mix of people. We bounce questions against each other. And what's interesting is all the questions we get. And but as far as Stuck Mike, it's been doing great. It's actually twice a month, and every so often we have special features. Like when I went down to interview Jonna Doolittle, Jimmy Doolittle's granddaughter, and also Harriet Quimby's biographer over at the Long Island Aviation Hall of Fame.
Yeah, right.
And those are the kind of things that are happening there. That we're doing some really neat special events, and it is growing. And I think that we really are committed to keeping it going. And we just have this incredible diverse group there. And when we get together, Len and I kind of we're like Abbott and Costello. You know, we start working. We have this incredible, like, it's like oil and vinegar. You know, we get together and we don't really get, you know, come all the way together on things, but we still, you know, I tell people we taste good when it's all done.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's been fun. It's been a blast. I never in a million years thought that I would be able to be sitting with Dora, like, and because of the Stuck Mike Avcast, Dora, who was one of the WASPs and was one of the few women, one of two women that flew the B-29. And I actually was there the day she flew it again 7 years later. And that never would have happened without getting involved in the whole podcasting realm and the Stuck Mike Avcast.
Yeah, it does open up all kinds of opportunities that you wouldn't have otherwise. And the same has been true for us.
Yeah, sure. Social media itself, I think, has been a boon to aviation that a lot of people never expected. I mean, let's face it, how many of us know each other now that in another life we would probably never have met?
Yeah, for sure.
And it's just, and it continues to grow. That's what I think is going to be really interesting for the aviation industry. If people like you, Carl, and all the rest of us could keep kind of, pumping it up. I mean, there are an awful lot of people out there that really do care about the industry, and they're really trying to make a difference, and they're trying to keep young people involved, and it's so important. And so we have to just keep doing what we're doing.
Oh,
yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And this social media, it's amazing. I mean, how many times have you sat there listening to a podcast and found yourself talking to it? Or actually screaming at it, saying, "You idiot, what are you talking?" As a matter of fact, I did that a couple of weeks ago with Rob Mark. As a matter of fact, I'm sitting there, no, you're wrong, you know? And I wanted to call you out. I won't mention it now, but it was an issue as far as phones on planes and you know, a lot. It's so I'm like sitting there saying, no, this is an issue that I feel passionate about. And I'm sitting there talking to what? A podcast. It's this little device, and I'm yelling at it, you know?
All right. Well, Carl, thank you so much. Why don't you, again, go through the links, the sites, the Twitter handles and so forth, where our listeners can find more of you online.
Sure. You can find me at my main aviation website is expertaviator.com with links to everything in Facebook and Twitter. My aviation careers podcast is simply aviationcareerspodcast.com. And on Twitter, it's Flying Careers. And, you know, of course, there's the Stuck Mike Avcast and the folks there. And you can find us at stuckmikeavcast.com with links to all those. And when I'm not doing that, go to down to sunandfun.org and check out Sun and Fun Radio, and you'll be able to listen. It's streaming right now, the interviews we did during that. So I'm out there all the time doing stuff. So come on by. I'd like to hear some comments, questions, and love to hear from everybody out there.
Fantastic. Thanks, Carl. Now, can you stick around with us for a while?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And now with his This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 4, Episode Number 20, June 24th through June 30th. June 24th, 1924. Patria 2 and Arco de Havilland DH-9A crashes in Macau after completing an 11,000-mile trip. The commander Brito Pace and commander Sarmiento de Brissès and their mechanic, Manuel Guerra, had taken off from Lisbon, Portugal on April 7th, 1924 to fly around the world. The DH-9 actually was their second aircraft. The original, Patria, was a Breguet 16. Patria suffered a severe engine failure over India, was then replaced by the DH-9. They continued the journey eastward till a severe storm forced them over China and forced them back to Macau. It was there they decided to end their round-the-world attempt. On June 26, 1909, Glenn Curtiss makes the first commercial sale of an aircraft in the United States. Curtiss had set up the Herring Curtiss Company in March of that year. The sale of the Curtiss Pusher to the Aeronautical Society of New York was for $7,500. Adjusted for inflation, that would be $174,102.27 in current currency. Because of that, the Wright brothers sued Curtiss for selling the aircraft without a license from them, thus beginning a long-time war between the two companies. Eventually, it would be settled, and we would come up with Curtiss Wright as a corporation. June 27, 1950, a C-54 was trying to evacuate civilians from Incheon and is jumped by Yak-9s, 11s, and Lag-7s. F-82Fs of the 68th Fighter All-Weather Squadron defend the C-54. Lieutenant William Skeeter Hudson and his radar operator, Lieutenant Carl Frazier, turned into the Yak-11 after sustaining damage in their left rudder. After pulling a high G turn, Hudson let loose with his six 50 caliber machine guns. The first rounds caused the Yak to fly into a second burst. The second burst ripped off the wing and reached the fuel tank. The pilot bailed out, and the observer went into the ground with the airplane. The pilot, once on the ground, found himself surrounded by South Koreans who promptly shot him dead. Hudson and Frazier would return to base with the first air-to-air kill of the Korean conflict. June 29, 1972. A lone OV-10A was flying as a forward air controller on a FAC mission. The pilot, Captain Stephen L. Bennett, would be awarded the Medal of Honor by President Ford posthumously for that mission. His citation reads as follows. Captain Bennett was the pilot of a light aircraft flying an artillery adjustment mission along a heavily defended segment of route structure. The large concentration of enemy troops was massing for an attack on a friendly unit. Captain Bennett requested a tactical air support, was advised that none was available. He also requested artillery support, but this too was denied due to close proximity of the friendly troops to the target. Captain Bennett was determined to aid the endangered unit and elected to strafe the hostile positions. After four such passes, the enemy force began to retreat. Captain Bennett continued the attack, but as he completed his fifth strafing pass, his aircraft was struck by a surface-to-air missile, which severely damaged the left engine and the left main landing gear. As fire spread in the left engine, Captain Bennett realized that recovery at a friendly airfield was impossible. He instructed his observer to prepare for an ejection, but was informed by the observer that his parachute had been shredded by the force of the impacting missile. Although Captain Bennett had a good parachute, he knew if he ejected, the observer would have no chance of survival. With complete disregard of his own life, Captain Bennett elected to ditch the aircraft over the Gulf of Tonkin, even though he realized that as a pilot of this aircraft type had never survived the ditching. The ensuing impact upon the water caused the aircraft to cartwheel and severely damaged the front cockpit, making escape for Captain Bennett impossible. The observer successfully made his way out of the aircraft and was rescued. Captain Bennett's unparalleled concern for his companion, extraordinary heroism, and intrepidity above and beyond the call of duty at the cost of his life were in keeping with the highest traditions of the military service and reflect a great deal of credit upon himself and the United States Air Force. Airplane Geeks, Airplane of the Week, the Martin M130 China Clipper. As always, it's my segment, and I'll write what I want clause. Today, I'm invoking that as a way to say thanks to the art department of Thrombey Air. I know how much trouble it was for Sally, Arthur, Sheila, Theo, and Wombat to make that art to celebrate our young Daniel's leaving. So thank you again. As a reward, we'll talk about the China Clipper, per your request. The real one, the Martin M130. After the success of the Sikorsky S-42, Juan Tripp wanted a larger, more powerful aircraft. Tripp, in order to sport on Sikorsky, asked Glenn Martin to design a heavier, longer-ranged aircraft. Tripp wanted to open up the Pacific. He wanted an aircraft that could carry its own weight without refueling to either England or Hawaii nonstop. The S-42 was used to deter the island hopping routes in the Pacific, though it was stripped down and could carry no passengers, only the two pilots and the fuel. The M-130, or the Martin Ocean Transport, first flew out of Baltimore Harbor on December 30, 1934. The high-wing flying boat had four Pratt & Whitney Arth 1830 twin wasps with variable pitch props. The wing had a span of 130 feet in comparison to the 118 feet of the S-42. Pan Am would pay $417,000 for three airframes. The three would be given the names the China Clipper, the Hawaii Clipper, and the Philippine Clipper. The China Clipper would be the first aircraft to enter service. Piloted by Captain Edward Music, the China Clipper would make the first trans-Pacific air-mail flight. 11,000 letters were aboard the aircraft, and the aircraft would return safely to San Francisco on December 6, 1935, after departing for China on November 22nd. The navigator on that mission was Fred Noonan, who would eventually become famous for another Pacific flight. Or infamous, depending upon who you want to talk to. The M-130 could carry 18 people in sleep berths or 36 people in seats. The crew was either 6 or 9, and it depended upon how many stewards they had aboard the aircraft. The Hawaii Clipper made the first California to Philippines passenger flight on October 21, 1936, and returned safely to San Francisco on November 4th. The Philippine Clipper opened up Hong Kong on October 14, 1936, with a departure and arrived 9 days later. It was a mail flight of the China Clipper that caught the world's attention. Eventually, Pan Am used the China Clipper as a universal term for their flying boats. Pan Am would build bases in Honolulu, Wake Island, Midway Island, and Guam. These way stations would become huge points of conflict because of their significance during World War II. July 1938, the Hawaii Clipper disappeared somewhere between Guam and Manila Harbor. 9 crew and 6 passengers were lost. The Philippine Clipper survived the Battle of Wake Island and was pressed into service as a transport by the U.S. Navy. It met its fate by crashing into a mountain on final approach to San Francisco Harbor. Lastly, in July of 1945, the China Clipper broke apart on landing on the islands of Trinidad and Tobago, killing all aboard. Martin built a fourth Clipper called the Russian Clipper for the Soviet Union. The M-156 was a larger winged, twin-tailed version of the M-130. Pan Am rejected the M-156 for the Boeing 314 flying boat. Martin sold the plans to the Soviets for mass production. However, with the war with Germany would prevent that. Only one M-156 was ever built. The M-156 could berth 26 instead of 18, and its wingspan was 27 feet longer than the M-130. The M-130 opened up the Pacific, though their successes were short-lived. However, the legend of the China Clipper still lives. To learn more about clippers without sails, I recommend reading the Nick Grant Adventures by Jamie Dodson, a friend of our podcast. Check out his books at www.nickgrantadventures.com. So we'll run the randomizer, and the choice for next week is we're going gliding, the Waco CG4A, otherwise known in British service as the Hadrian. And that's the way it was June 24th through the 30th. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
David, nice job. Do we have to mention that thing about the listener that wrote in that mentioned the randomizer isn't really random because it's something?
I forgot. Yeah, we did get a question about that.
Yeah, I mean, I just thought
there. If folks, I have a spreadsheet that I load into something called random.org. And if you go to random.org, they have a random generator. You load in the spreadsheet, you hit go, and it will pop up in order. It will randomize the order in which the Excel spreadsheet's on. That's how I do the randomizer. The only time it's changed is when something comes up and I invoke my right to write whatever That's I right. want. So, but for all intents and purposes, it is random on what we're going to do on the show, because that way it keeps it interesting for me.
All right, very good.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, June 24th, 2012.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 203. Grant, gee, it was nice to have a week off, and what a great episode last week. You know, kudos to all the guys there, and a big shout-out to Tim Bell. What a mighty effort. You know, Tim, I hope you didn't do the trip all the way from the West Coast to the East Coast just for that, but if that was the reason you did it, mate, that's an awesome effort. And you got to speak to Rob Mark and survived it.
Yeah, and he also brought over a whole lot of fruit tingles. Score, Tim. That was great. Well done. Now they all know what a fruit tingle's like.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, Tim Bell, you should have taken some Tim Tams because I happen to know Rob Mark likes them.
Yeah, well, it'd get you more than an interview if you had a few Tim Tams, I tell you.
Well, speaking of things that people are not liking, the South Australian government is not liking Tiger Airways at the moment. You know, Grant, they must have been reading from my playbook, but for different reasons. As it turns out, they've given Tiger Airways $2.25 million in government grants, and now that Tiger Airways is not flying to Adelaide anymore, well, you know, they want the money back.
That's right, mate. The money was given to Tiger to help it set up its Adelaide base, but a year after they closed that base, they still haven't paid it back, and the government has been chasing with them. And apparently, a year ago, they said that they would get every cent of the $2.25 million from Tiger. However, at the moment, they're still trying to figure out how.
According to a Tiger Airways spokeswoman, the airline was, and I quote, engaging in ongoing dialogue with Adelaide Airport and the South Australian government in relation to the resumption of services, blah, 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 blah. You know what? They're never going to get that money back. And I'll tell you what, South Australian government, don't try calling their customer service centre outside of ours, because I'm still waiting for my customer complaint to be answered from 2008.
Not that you're holding a grudge, but you know, it's something else that's taken rather a long time to come through. And you may remember a little while ago we spoke about Bomber Command veterans being sent over to the UK for the unveiling of the Bomber Command Memorial, and how we were a little bit boo-hiss on our government for only sending a few of them when there were quite a few veterans here in Australia. Well, it seems that they've decided they're going to send an official party of 30, but also they're sending 70 others in a funded but unofficial party.
Okay, well, I tell you what, it's a shame, Grant, that it had to come to the sort of jumping up and down from people such as ourselves, and also a lot of people who can make a lot more noise than we can, to get the government to see sense on this, but a good result, I think. It's good to see that some public pressure has worked here and worked for the greater good. That's good to see, and I certainly hope that all those Bomber Command crews get over there and memorialise that time as they see fit and in the most appropriate way. Good to see.
Indeed, mate, indeed. And the Kiwi group have gone over on one of the RNZAF 757s.
Oh, there you go. So they're going in style, Grant.
Indeed, mate. They're going on the sheep shack.
I was wondering if you were going to say that, actually. Well, talking about a slightly shorter flight during the week, a delegation from Qantas Airways, including their CEO, Alan Joyce, they took a very short flight from Sydney, it seems, down to Canberra to lobby some politicians about various issues, including the possibility of Etihad coming in here and taking over a bigger stake of Virgin, as we reported a couple of weeks ago. And perhaps they were talking a bit about the Qantas Sale Act and how perhaps it might be a good idea if, you know, they would relax it.
Yeah, mate, to quote a few people, crying wolf, perhaps. Yeah. Oh, dear, dear. Etihad might come in and sponsor Virgin, and suddenly they might dump a whole lot of excess capacity on the market, and that might make things really bad for us. Well, hello, Qantas, that's exactly what you're proposing to do, to kick Virgin out of the market, because Qantas were going to put lots of capacity on the East Coast to West Coast route over to Perth, and as a result, that would flood the market, and they were going to try and do a price war with Virgin. But now somebody might even potentially be hinting at doing it back to them, and they're running to mummy.
Yes, they might be. They've been talking to people from the Transport Minister's Office. That's, of course, Anthony Albanese, who's the Minister for Transport, and a number of other things. Also the Minister for Naked Body Scanners, as we've also found out during the week. But interestingly, Grant, they've also been talking to the federal opposition, and looks like they've been talking to the Shadow Treasurer, Joe Hockey. And interestingly, Grant, Mr. Hockey here has said that maybe it's time to have a look at the arrangements governing Qantas. Now, that would be interesting because the coalition government, if they were to take power next year, which on the current polls they probably would, does that mean that they might look at relaxing the restrictions on percentage of investment from foreign owners in Qantas?
Well, I think what it really means is that they might potentially consider the merest possibility of maybe thinking that it could be a good idea.
Yes, they could just be saying anything as long as it gets them into government grant.
Ah, there you go. What's the most vacuous and impossible thing? A politician's promise.
I tell you what, Grant, it hasn't all been challenging news for Alan Joyce during the week. A quick article here in AustralianAviation.com.au says here that Joyce takes over as chairman of IATA very shortly.
That's right. He gets to spend a year as the chairman of IATA, at which point Joyce is going to stand up there and he's going to lobby very, very hard to get every airline to become a low-cost carrier. I mean, he's already started it. Look, the Qantas A380s are getting reconfigured. More economy seats, less business class seats, a couple of toilets coming out, and one of the self-service bars disappearing. I mean, you know, it's getting closer to Jetstar every day.
Well, you did call that a couple of years ago, mate.
I know. I still reckon we're going to see a Jetstar A380, and maybe it will still have a red roux on the tail, but it's going to be Jetstar on the inside.
Yeah, very true. I tell you what, you know, they should, considering those A380s do very long-haul flights, I don't know about the wisdom of taking more toilets out of those aircraft. In fact, they probably ought to be putting more in.
Well, they've gone from about 450 passengers to 480, and they have taken out a toilet.
I tell you what, mate, if it started to get too smelly in those Qantas jets next time we fly over to America, I might just ditch them and say aloha.
Aloha?
Well, there you go. That's about as much Hawaiian as I can speak.
Oh, mahalo. So why are you speaking Hawaiian, Steve? You're going to get a detour via Hawaii?
Well, I'll tell you what, if I was to go via Brisbane, I could do that. As Hawaiian Airlines has announced that it will start direct flights to Brisbane in November, making it the only US carrier to serve the Queensland capital, according to our good friends at Australian Aviation.
Really? Okay, so I know they're coming into Sydney as well, but now they're going into Brisbane, huh? Well, you know, you can go from one tropical paradise to another, according to most people who live in Brisbane, but anyhow.
And interestingly, Grant, bucking a trend of all the carriers these days coming into Australia with 777s, Hawaiian Airlines is going to be, in fact, operating 767-300ERs.
Oh, 767s into Brisbane, huh? It's interesting because they're using A330s into Sydney, and that's where they're also a partner with Virgin Australia's Velocity Loyalty Program.
I tell you what, Virgin, they're really into all these sort of arrangements. They do them really well, and they've also announced that they're going to now code-share with Virgin America, so actually that seems probably one of the more logical ones. In fact, it surprises me they don't do that already.
Well, I think there was that little problem of, you know, you could code share all the way up to San Francisco or Los Angeles, but then it was that long swim to Australia. Doing this link up with Hawaiian will give you yet another way to get from the west coast of the US to the east coast of Australia.
And turning our gaze across the Tasman now, and just some quick New Zealand news before we finish up. As Rob Fyfe steps away from the chairmanship of Air New Zealand, he has been replaced by Christopher Luxon.
Well, that's great, mate, but who the heck was Christopher Luxon?
Christopher Luxon, of course, was previously the Group General Manager of International at Air New Zealand, so he's stepping into the top job, and boy, I tell you what, mate, he's got some big shoes to fill with Rob Fyfe, as we've mentioned many times in the past. Pretty well respected, pretty highly thought of, it seems, by most of the people that we know that work for Air New Zealand, and let's hope that Mr. Luxon continues with that that positive attitude that we seem to see from that airline.
So long as he can do a haka, he's in with Air New Zealand.
There you go. Well, every Kiwi I've ever met seems to be able to do that. Grant, I wonder if they can do that aboard a Royal New Zealand Navy Sea Sprite.
Yeah, I bet you they probably could. There's a bit of room in the back of those. New Zealand is talking with Command Corporation about the possible sale of some more Super Sea Sprites. This is interesting. These are the helicopters that Australia tried to make work with only two crew instead of three or four, and completely stuffed it up and had to let them all go. And the Kiwis are loving them.
According to a statement from the company, the potential sale would include 11 of the SH-2G Super Sea Sprite helicopters, and that would supplement the current fleet operated by the New Zealand Navy of five of the Super Sea Sprite SH-2Gs. And they've been in service since 2001. Interestingly here, Grant, looks like they're not getting a lot of flight hours, or at least falling short of their targeted flight hours due to maintenance issues, including corrosion and vibration issues.
That's not real good, is it?
Not really good at all, Grant, but as you say, at least they did go into service with the New Zealand Defence Force, unlike over here with the Australian Defence Force. Grant, I tell you what, just before we finish up here, there was a listener that wrote in two or three episodes back talking about the Avanti aircraft, that strange-looking one that sounds really cool. If you'd like to see a video about that, well, we actually recorded, well, when I say we, I actually mean you, Grant, recorded an interview at Avalon last year on the flight deck with the Avanti Chief Test Pilot.
That's right, mate. It was a bit of yoga in the morning to get into the right-hand seat. Amazing cockpit to sit in.
We'll send Max a link to put in the show notes if you'd like to have a look at that video. You can find that on our YouTube video channel. And Grant, while we're doing the shameless self-promotion bit here, we should also point out that you can find archives of several of our Australia Desk at australiadesk.net. Grant, we've got about 33 of them, I think, loaded in there now.
Oh, about 35. I've got a few more up now.
There we go. Absolutely. So australiadesk.net if you'd like to find that, and flyingdownunder.com if you'd like to find some of our segments that we do for Milford and Charlie over there at Flight Time Radio. Now, Grant, as we sign off for this week, you're about to jump in the bus and head way up to the far northwest of the state to do some ballooning for the week.
That's right, mate. I'm later this week, I'm going to be jumping in one of our four-wheel drives and taking some gear up into the, as you said, far northwest, where I'm going to spend a week flying balloons and having a blast.
Absolutely. As you do some more progress on getting your commercial balloon license. So we wish you all the best with that, mate. Don't know whether we'll have you on next week's report, but if we do, it'll be by phone. But hopefully you won't fly too far off into the outback.
Hopefully I'll still have some coverage.
Absolutely. Well, until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm still Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
All right. Thanks, guys. Boy, Tim Bell was spectacular. And I think, I think he did travel from the West Coast, where he was for some activities, all the way to the East Coast for the event last weekend.
Yeah, I love the Avant Air, by the way, or the Piaggios. They're pretty cool.
Beautiful design.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
as a matter of fact,
nice.
Their Avant Air is just based right around the corner from me here. And I'm actually going to be interviewing one of the folks there at Avant Air.
Fantastic.
And, cool looking plane. Yeah. Just an odd sound. They fly over my place all the time. And just a lot different than most aircraft.
Yeah, well, that's what everybody says, that they have a unique sound. All right, here's Peter Johnson across the pond.
Having some aviation quiet time led me to think about what to talk about next, and I thought I'd tell you a story. It's not one I've told before. I'm a trainee pilot who dropped out near the end of my qualifying training. And why? I was a competent pilot who'd soloed after only 8 hours. The 15th of June, 1999 was a memorable day at Pantanger Aerodrome. Chris McGonigal, my instructor, asked me to stop the aircraft and he simply got out. Said good luck, one circuit at the Hertfordshire Aerodrome later, and I was a real pilot. I'd flown an aeroplane on my own, a lifetime ambition, a personal goal, a major milestone in my then young 35 years of life. 6 days later, I was crossing the Atlantic to Titusville, Florida, an Arthur Dunn airfield, to continue my flying training with a 2-week training program that was just about flying and nothing else. A dream come true. But the dream became really hard work when I started to struggle to solo in US airspace. I'd simply lost the art of landing. It just wouldn't come to me. My instructor didn't really help. He was simply hour building and not really focused on student development. Nice guy, but poor trainer. It took the intervention of a flying school owner, a fearsome man and a natural pilot 3 days later to simply go up with me, swing the 152 around and demonstrate the landing profile time and time again. Within 20 minutes, I had it back and a replacement instructor, Oren, was assigned to me and the next day I soloed in the US. Ripped shirt and hosed down, I flew as much as I could in the remaining time, studying ground school, hanging out in the FBO, and generally living flying for the next week or so. On my last day in Florida, I'd managed to gain the skills and competence to undertake my solo cross-country flight. I had about 26 hours in my logbook then. I was confident in my flying skills, but a little apprehensive about all the radio and navigation facing me on my flight, which was to go from Arthur Dunn to Flagler County and then Deland Taylor, crossing back through Orlando's airspace and overflying Daytona Beach. Up early, flight planning already run through, checked, double-checked, and then signed off by the CFI. The biggest concern we had was the weather. As usual, in Florida during the summer, thunderstorms are a real threat. One thing I'd learned about flying in Florida in June was that the air was really heavy and bumpy due to the heat and moisture, and I'd suffered many a bumpy journey and crosswind landing during my 2 weeks there. I'd also managed to have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity pre-9/11, where the skies were a place with a little bit more freedom than offered to the general aviation community today. I'd get into the school early in the morning, and once my CFI briefing had been done, I was free to go off on my own and do my solo flying 20 miles up the coast and generally absorb in the freedom of flight. And I'm one of those lucky few pilots who've been given permission to cross over the straits to Kennedy and fly down the shuttle landing runway at 500 feet. Now there's another story for later. So back to my solo cross-country flight. Fueled, checked, wheels up at 8:15 and I was on my way. But there was a nagging issue that I couldn't quite understand. The aircraft was fine, the flight plan was filed, my CFI was happy. Oh well, I flew north and reported into Daytona Beach Air Traffic Control. November 49819, student pilot on a cross-country flight. I announced my intentions and immediately got the report that there was a weather front heading south and pilots were warning of poor conditions and heavy rain. But I pressed on. But that was error number two. Error number one was not being fully prepared at the first sign of trouble to abort and return to Arthur Dunn. Too confident? Possibly arrogant? What's that saying? There's old pilots and there's bold pilots, but there's no old bold pilots. Aborting the flight never really crossed my mind. Even though I had my diversionary fields all planned and scheduled, I simply never assumed I'd need them. I know, I can hear Rob sighing now at my foolhardiness and cockiness, and with hindsight, I readily admit to both. A few minutes further on, I could now see the weather front approaching directly in front of me from the north. The cumulus was towering probably 10,000 feet into the sky, and visibility, even 10 to 15 miles away, was shaded in rain. Another warning from ATC, and doubt struck. Okay, so two warnings, it's time to get going and divert, as there's no way I could fly through the oncoming rain. Or should I turn back? If I diverted, I could do the trip in reverse and fly to land to Flagler and back. Okay, so work out the radius, fly the new track, advise ATC. Oh dear, the weather was now closing faster than I could accommodate it, and activity in the cockpit was getting a little intense. Looking off to the west, the land was now covered in rain, and I was now faced with a wall of weather to the north, to the west, and with the Atlantic to my east, it was time to turn back south and head for home. That was one bumpy turn, I thought, as I plotted my course home. The weather front was now buffeting the aircraft quite heavily, and I'd moved from excited to apprehensive, and although I'd been in the air for about 40 minutes, I was exhausted. Now, Arthur Dunn's pretty much situated north-south, and I'd departed directly to the north. As the weather front chased me back, and I focused purely on flying the aeroplane, navigating and communicating, some basic errors started to lead to potentially major safety issues. Sweating and heavily stressed flying the 152 in front of this weather, I saw the field. I made my calls, I lined up on the runway, and came straight in. However, what I should have done was enter the circuit, fly downwind, base and final. But there wasn't any traffic and a clear runway, and I went for it. And of course, the most basic flying error then led to an almost disastrous landing. Flying with the weather front and not into the wind, I landed far too fast. With heavy gusts, and as the aircraft entered the ground effect territory, that few feet above the runway, a gust caught me and blew the aircraft sideways. It skidded onto the surface and off the edge of the concrete runway. I was going very fast, far too fast, and losing control. I applied the brakes only for the aircraft to slew around and eventually skid to a stop on the wet grass. I managed to miss all the runway lights and signs. That was lucky. In what was only a few seconds but seemed like hours, everything came to a halt. Instinct and training made me do the emergency shutdown procedures, and I exited the aircraft. It was blustery and the rain was arriving, and there was no one around. And after a few minutes, with no one attending me or coming to find me, I thought I'd better check the aircraft out and see if it's okay, and it was completely unharmed. So I got back in, started it up, taxied back onto the taxiway, and parked back at the FBO. Sweating, shaking, and grateful for being alive, I stumbled into the flying school, and my CFI looked up and said, "What are you doing here? You're supposed to be at Flagler by now." Realising they hadn't heard my calls, I asked if anyone had seen my landing. "No, was it a good one?" my CFI asked. No one had seen it. No one knew how close I'd come to breaking the aircraft, and no one knew I'd really made a mess of that flight. It was okay, a bit bumpy, but I had to turn back because the weather front closed in earlier than the briefing. Oh well, said my CFI. That's a shame. It's your last day. Maybe you can try this again this afternoon. No chance, was what went through my mind. No chance. And for those wondering about the aircraft, it was fine. And for those wondering about my aircraft crash landing, no one ever asked, so I never told. Too many lessons to take from this, but I only flew again a few times back in the UK after that. I hated the restricted airspace and then the awful pressure that 9/11 put on general aviation. So I let go and I didn't finish my licence. But I don't regret anything about the flying training journey, except one thing. Overconfident flying can be a dangerous thing. It's not that I won't fly again. I can't wait for the chance to do it. It's just I'll be a much safer pilot next time. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Hey, it's a great story, huh?
That was impressive.
All right, it's time for Grill the Geeks again. This time we've got a couple of questions that come in from listeners. First one comes in from Daniel. He's from Australia.
Why is everybody from Australia?
It seems that way, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
I'm not sure what to make of that, but at least the Australians I've met, I really like.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. And I like them better when they come armed with Tim Tams.
Yeah. Okay, back to Grill the Geeks. So we have this question from Daniel. And Carl, you can play along too.
Okay.
And in fact, in this one, I think we're going to need you. Well, I don't know. We have Rob. Okay, so these are some questions on material important to pilots. All right, he's looking for three formulas. Ready for this? What is the formula for lift? What is the formula that links stall speed to bank angle for a balanced level turn? And what is the formula for density altitude?
Okay. Well, I can tell you right now, I am not taking this opportunity away from Carl. I'm just going to for one shut up.
You
just
chicken.
Let Thanks, the man Robert. Answer the question.
I love it.
I know, because we're out of this one. What's the formula for lift? Do either of you guys know the formula for lift?
Oh, gosh. Off the top of my head, let's see.
Are you talking about the mathematical formula?
The mathematical formula. This is hard.
The harder, well, you pull back to increase lift and you pull back harder and then lift goes away. And then you have more drag and you crash.
Okay. You want the formula?
Isn't it speed over drag?
Lift, I'll give you the answer. Lift, this is according to Daniel. Lift is equal to half rho V squared S times CL, where rho is the air density, V is the net velocity of the air through which the wing is passing, S is the wing area, and CL is the coefficient of lift, which itself is the wing's camber times the angle of attack. I didn't know that. Camber times.
Well, no, wait a minute. All right, you guys don't know that, of course, the listeners don't realize that we're IMing each other sometimes while questions are going on. And since he's not a regular member of the show, Carl was writing something down, and he wrote down exactly what you said, Max. I mean, he did. I just want
actually,
to
I
sure.
started out with the integral to get that equation, yeah, but now I stopped at that point, and I'm done.
How about
now, it's that was good though. Actually, he's correct on that one.
So, well, okay, the next one, the formula that links stall speed to bank angle for a balanced level turn.
Oh, wait a minute. Stall speed increases with twice. No, wait a minute. Oh, boy.
Jeez.
60, and then
it increases by the square formula of the bank angle or something like that.
Yeah, you're kind of close. Well, you're getting there. No, you're not either. You want me to tell you what
All
it
right,
is?
All right. Well, they blew the first one, so the guy's getting pins. Do we have to suffer through the other two?
Yeah, because it's hysterical. Well, let me read you this one. The stall speed is equal to the regular stall speed. What does that mean? Times the square root of the load factor. The load factor itself is 1 on the cosine of the bank angle. or parentheses, the secant of the bank angle. Okay.
And your point is what, David?
And I guess, do you guys have your slide rules when you're doing this bank stuff?
Oh, no. No, little computer says it's time to stall, and then we push the nose down and we don't stall.
See, that's much simpler.
When you make a tight turn, you just don't pull the wheel back. You just let the nose go down, and it flies real nice.
Okay,
of course, so you go down, but can't have everything.
So what was it? Say that again for the stall speed one more time. I want to see if we get that.
He says the stall speed is equal to the regular stall speed times the square root of the load factor.
Okay.
Then he says the load factor is the cosine of the bank angle, or rather, one on the cosine of the bank angle. Does that mean one over the cosine of the bank angle? Maybe they have funny mathematics in Australia, which he says is the secant of the bank angle, which is probably one over the cosine. Okay.
Wow, this is like old geometry.
This is tough.
Yeah.
All right. So
calculus.
The last one was the formula for density altitude, but I don't even think we're going to go there because
it's too dense.
It's too dense.
It's too dense.
Well, it has to be something related to temperature. I mean, obviously, but I don't know.
Outside air temperature Celsius minus 15 multiplied by 120 plus pressure altitude. And there's something in here about hectopascals minus 1113.2 multiplied, but forget it. So we don't know that stuff at all.
But you know what I think is really important, I appreciate his questions.
Okay.
And while we don't all have all those answers, those of us that fly know that we go into turn the aircraft into a 60-degree bank on short final close to the ground. It's very dangerous.
Right.
You know? And we know that we don't want to be really slow because we all understand the formula. I mean, we know what it will do. We may not be able to calculate it. And
you don't want to waste time in the airplane trying to figure it out.
You don't worry about calculating it stuff.
Okay.
But it's important to know and understand those terms and what they are because we ran across this the other day with really hot temperatures. Do you understand your density altitude and your pressure altitude and how they apply to your charts? And so that's important to know those terms.
So the
actual practical application, somebody else is going to be calculating that for you.
So I do hear density. All right, I'm not a pilot. I do hear density altitude mentioned a lot, it seems. So for the layperson, the non-pilot, what's density altitude? What does that mean?
For the regular pilot, they're going to say it's pressure altitude adjusted for a non-standard temperature. Density altitude basically is telling you how dense the area is, and it's kind of I think it's a misnomer because a higher density altitude means that the air that you're breathing and the air that's surrounding you is actually acting as if you're at a higher altitude because if you're at a higher altitude, it's actually less dense. And I always say it's a high density altitude. So if you're at 10,000 feet and it's at standard pressure and standard temperature, your density altitude is equal to your pressure altitude. But as the temperature goes up, of course, you know, it gets less dense. For those people that have problems breathing in the summer and breathing actually when it's really humid out, then they understand that fact that, yeah, I understand density altitude. I could be sitting on the ground, but the ground is as if it's up at an altitude of 3, 5, maybe even 10,000 feet. And that's really important to know, especially when you fly into the mountains. Like I fly in the mountains in Mexico, and we go into the airports that are at 8,300 feet. Well, the density altitude could actually be 10,000 feet. So the hotter it is, the higher the density altitude, because the air is less dense, which is the tough thing to understand.
And the worse the aircraft performs.
And the worse, just like you breathing, it needs to breathe too, and it's gonna perform worse. And the wings actually are affected by that too. Good point.
And that's why in the military there are always requirements for hot and high climates.
Yes.
Afghanistan is a number one for hot and high, meaning that you have a whole different parameters for your aircraft flight profiles. So it's a standard. That's a standard procedure, at least in the military, that you have to change everything, and the aircraft have to be able to fly in hot and high climates.
Hmm. Sure. All right. And I'm sure you've seen in the news that a lot of flights were canceled out of Denver recently because of the hot temperatures. And that's because the charts only show a certain density altitude, and you actually have to go and calculate that to make sure you can still take off with that density altitude.
Okay, interesting. All right, we just had a teaching moment. And we've used up a lot of time, so we're just going to do just the one Grill the Geeks question in the interest of time. We have some listener mail, and maybe we can get to a little bit of that. Unfortunately, we won't be able to get to it all. But we got a voicemail from, this is from student pilot Paul. This is on opening the window of a Cessna 172. Here's Paul.
Hi, geeks. This is student pilot Paul. I fly out of a KAVTF in Utah. I recently bought a 1969 Cessna 172K, and I have a question for you. Nowhere in the POH can I find information about the window. Can the window be open during flight? I'll be listening to hear your answer. Have a great one.
The way the FAA thinks about things is that If they think it's okay, they're going to tell you. And if you open a pilot's operating handbook and you cannot find the answer to the question that you want, it means you can't do it. That's why, just going back to that previous example that Carl was mentioning about hot and high takeoffs, when the temperature is above a certain temperature, they don't publish numbers for certain kinds of certain airports or certain weights in an airplane. There's a reason. That's your signal for the fact that you can't do it.
All right. Well, that's pretty straightforward.
But to add to that, on that one, on opening the window, I know there's, in certain manuals, they do have the window speed. And a lot of times in a Cessna, in most Cessnas, it's actually equivalent to the VNE or the never exceed speed. And that's on some of the Cessnas. Because we used to fly with the windows open all the time. Especially in Florida, but there is a, you do have to worry about it departing the aircraft. But there is, I think it's usually at the VNE speed, which you're hopefully not going to exceed that anyway.
For us nine pilots, VNE speed is
the,
what?
The never exceed speed. Thank you, David, for that. The never exceed speed is what that is, and that's usually the speed you're not going to go any faster than that. And the reason you don't go any faster is for many reasons. One of them is aircraft flutter, and then it departs controlled flight if you go faster than that. But yes, there's a lot of airplanes where you can. As a matter of fact, I did a lot of aerial photography and. We used to always fly with the windows open, but we would go at a slower speed just to make sure. You know, obviously those hinges are getting older. Right. You don't want that thing hitting the tail of the airplane.
Well, that's right, and that's what I was saying in the email, and that is a good point that we forgot to mention. That's what you're really worried about, not just breaking the latch, but if that window whacks the horizontal stabilizer somewhere, God knows what the reaction's going to be.
Oh, sure. But unfortunately, I'm looking at my 172 manual right now and trying to find the speed on there for the.
Well, let me know if you do. What year manual are you looking at?
This one is a 172S model, so this is an older, newer model compared to what he was talking about.
I might
about.
Have it in there because yeah, the older ones, the manual. If you look at manual, an old one versus a new one. Oh my lord!
Oh yeah, it's like the FAA regs. You know, control the plane, don't crash. Now you have like pages and pages of regulations. But I can't find it. It's in here somewhere. But I won't spend any more time on that. But if I find it, I will let you know. I do know that in the 182 that I owned, it was the VNE speed, and that's normally what it is as far as being able to open it in flight. But I won't. But don't take that advice. Make sure you look in your manual,
right?
Sure. And make sure that it's printed in that manual that you can do that. And if it doesn't say it, don't do it. is what Rob's trying to say.
Exactly. Okay. Great. Let's see. We heard from Eddie. Eddie sent some links to us that we'll put in the show notes. One that I particularly liked is a YouTube channel that's about turbine engines, and it's from someone who goes by Agent JZ, and he's got some playlists on power turbines and what they do, some afterburner videos, something on the J-47 turbojet, test cells, some other things as well. Kind of interesting. So we'll put that link in the show notes. Look for that. It's pretty interesting. Thanks to Eddie for sending those along. Ian Kershaw sent us an interesting photograph that showed some birds nesting in I think this was a 737-700 APU. Pigeons nesting in there. Last episode, we talked about bird strikes and things like that. Ian sort of points out that sometimes they don't hit, sometimes they just roost. And so thanks to Ian for that photo. It's pretty interesting. Okay, I think that's about all the time we have for listener mail. I want to thank everyone who sent it in. We really do have a huge pile of listener mail. In fact, we kind of have a little bit of a backlog on that. So I appreciate folks' patience. And if we don't get to read yours on the podcast, know that we all read them outside of the show. Okay, I think that'll do it then for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. I want to thank everyone for listening, and I'd like to thank our guest, Carl Valeri. Carl, once again, tell folks where they can find all your great content online.
Well, you can find my aviation website at expertaviator.com, and of course, my new podcast is aviationcareerspodcast.com. Those are the best places to find me.
Fantastic. We also want to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron and Steve Vischer. Find them at playingcrazydownunder.com. Also, Peter Johnson, and you can find him at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com, or, of course, his new podcast, aviationextended.co.uk, extended without the leading E. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online, and we'll start with Rob Mark. Rob, where do folks find you?
Well, let's see. Jetwine.com, Jetwine on Twitter, Jetwine on Facebook, Jetwine on Google Plus, hanging around the airport, looking over the fence at the airplanes, all kinds of fun places like that.
Fantastic. And David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on Google Plus as David Vanderhoof, or you can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com.
And I'm Max Flight. Look for me on Google Plus and Twitter as Max Flight. Also at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. You can find show notes for this episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast at airplanegeeks.com. There you'll see links to all the sites we mentioned in the podcast, some listener comments, and you can even buy Airplane Geeks t-shirts. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Just look for Airplane Geeks. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream this podcast right to your mobile phone. If you want to send us an email, that address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. And Antipane, what's that number?
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Bye now.
Night, everybody.
That would be interesting, wouldn't it? Ducting the toilets directly into the turbofans.
You could mix it with the used chip oil.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm always thinking, Grant. I'm always thinking.
3, 2, 1. Shit, what day? Come on!
What episode is it? Is it 202?
203. Hang on.
Are you sure?
I don't know.
This is what happens when you take a week off.
You fool! Who let us have a holiday? With Virgin, but now somebody might even potentially be hinting at doing it back to them, and they're running to mummy. What?
I don't know how to respond to that.
You there?
Rob?
Yes? Sorry, I was on mute. Hey, I was doing a David.
Yeah, I guess so.
I was working on a model airplane. Well, actually, I really wasn't. Simbu was trying to get in the way.
Well, after the Become a Pilot Day event, and Rob, you had to leave early to head back home, but a bunch of us, in fact, about 11 of us, went out to dinner. When we'd all arrived at the restaurant, we thought it'd be a good idea to go around the table and introduce ourselves. And so we decided that the way to do that would be for each of us to say our name and maybe what relationship we had with aviation, if we were a podcaster or a pilot or whatever. And finally, who was our favorite Australian? And that's how we introduced ourselves.
And the winner was...
I thought John Conway had the best answer. John pointed to the guy sitting next to him and said, him.
Oh, that's right.
The guy sitting next to him was me.
Well, my favorite was Anthony Simmons.
Okay, I don't even know who that is.
Anthony Simmons, the view from the lounge on Plane Crazy Down Under.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know, I was, for some reason, I was thinking of when we talked about favorite Australians, I was thinking of TV stars and